You're listening to No Dice, No Problem, a new monthly Asians Represent variety show hosted by Drew Kwan and me, Daniel Kwan, on the One Shot Podcast Network. Check out uncut video and other exclusive content at patreon.com/AZNSrepresent. I just feel like I need to be working all the time. And then if I'm not working, something's wrong. And I don't know if this is like a holdover from academia where it's like, oh, if you're not working on a new paper, if you're not doing research,
sure,
then somebody else is and they're getting ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of where this comes from.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. And even with it within like TTRPGs, because there's such like a pervasive sort of hustle culture, in part because A, there's very little money in RPGs, so you're constantly having to work.
Yeah.
There's very little stability unless you work for one of the big companies.
Yeah, very, B, I think, very nearly. I think almost everyone is a freelancer, so that you have to, you are just forced into the hustle, you know?
Yeah. And especially with like Twitter and all of that stuff, we're constantly, it's constantly reinforcing the fact that if you aren't talking about your work, if you aren't putting something out publicly, then you're doing something wrong. And you can't like quietly work on something.
Yeah.
Or at least if you're quietly working on something, you feel like you're behind if you're doing so.
It feels like an industry in which you often cannot let your work speak for itself. You know, if you're not spending every little moment engaging or creating engagement and doing things that put a spotlight on you, then you're not getting ahead in any particular way, or you're actively falling behind, which I think is really unhealthy.
Networking.
Yeah, I think it's really unhealthy for the industry. Like when you look at Twitter, you know, so many people are saying good things, but sometimes we're all saying too much, in my opinion. Like we can all just like take a break.
Yeah, take a break and then return like the next day and tweet 15 times a day.
Yeah, and some people, you know, there's a lot of like rage baiting. There's a lot of just, I don't know, there's a lot of drama in the space. And a lot of the drama is because of genuinely bad people and they're being shitty. And I am not saying that they don't deserve to be called out. Of course they do. But then there's like the extra stuff. There's there's like the interpersonal drama that people put online for the purpose of getting views when that didn't need to be there, you know?
Yeah, clicks, likes, or just, I feel like a lot of people just feel like they have to say something.
Yeah.
Like they have to say something. Like I have to take a stance right now. And then, you know, a week later, I have to put out an apology thread.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
It happens a lot. And it's exhausting. And I think I've hit a point in my burnout where the things that I really love are not catching my attention.
Sure.
You know, it's like I'm less excited about the projects I'm working on, like my independent projects I'm working on, or I don't want to like read an RPG book, or I don't want to do, you know, one of the things that I've had a hard time doing is I think I'm just so burnt out that like my hobbies aren't as interesting to me right now. And I don't like that. I don't like that. And I think a part of it is just because social media is just so exhausting. And I think that's why I like No Dice, No Problem, because we aren't trying to put out something educational like Asians Represent. Mm-hmm. There's no pressure to do like sort of the harder stuff that we do on the main show. And it's just, hey, it's just two dudes talking about taking shits.
Well, it's really nice because, you know, it feels like No Dice, No Problems mission statement is that Daniel and Drew have fun. That's it. That's it. We don't have to worry about the rest of it. And hopefully other people resonate with it and have fun with us as well. And I think that they do. But then we don't have to worry about the extra stuff, and we get to just talk about the things that we do enjoy just from the perspective of, I enjoy this, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a podcast where two friends just talk about what they love and what you know, makes them happy. Mm-hmm. Like, and I really hope we get to do it live.
That'd be lit.
At like Big Bad Con.
Yeah.
I really hope that works out. By the way, did you fill out your scholarship application?
I think I did. I'll have to check after this. I'm pretty sure
check,
I did.
Check after.
Yeah.
But yeah, we. I really look forward to when we can do this live, because I don't know if we can do. I don't know what an Asians Represent Live looks like.
Sure.
Because like I think an Asians Represent Live could be, hey, let's talk about cultural consulting, or let's talk about this particular genre of fiction. But I want something more like more casual, kind of like.
I still think a great
the bathroom one.
A great. Okay, I have a couple ideas for live podcasts, which they're not live in the typical sense. Like I don't. It'd be
in person recording.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so one idea, as we've mentioned before, is a bathroom. I think it'd just be so funny.
For people who are new, it's just us sitting in like neighboring stalls, just running them the microphone cable underneath the bottom or over the top and just talking while on the toilet.
Yeah, yeah.
Such a stupid idea.
And
so funny
what I think we should do is we should get an agreement with the facility where we basically rent out that singular bathroom. And we have friends of the podcast every so often come in to, quote, go to the bathroom. But then they just sit in the next stall and we just interview
and
them.
And just feed another mic over.
We just interview them from the other stall. That's so good.
And we're just, yeah, God. There's that one. I also love the idea of us doing a podcast while on a road trip.
God, that'd be fun.
I did that with, I drove to Gen Con in 2019 with the Broadswords podcast. Mm-hmm. They don't make content anymore. But we recorded like a podcast in the car. And I don't think it ever saw the light of day.
Oh, right.
But I really want to do No Dice, No Problem on the road.
God,
like we're just like, it's just like a road trip and we're going to go and get food somewhere. Kind of like, I really like what the Try Guys are doing with the tripod.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that format. And I think it would be really funny with us if we did a mega podcast while on a road trip. Like, problem is, like, we're so far apart.
Yeah, it's a whole road trip just to get to each other.
Yeah, right? Unless we recorded our audio and video separately while we're driving to each other. And then in the podcast, we time it. So we have like an hour of us driving to each other. And then we finally meet and then the videos merge.
That's funny.
I think like,
we just funny. We just vlog on our way to each other.
Yeah, and then the end of the vlog is us finally meeting up.
Yeah.
Which I guess we could.
We could.
We could do for a Big Bad Con, but not in a podcast format because we'd have to.
That's the whole video.
I guess we'd have to talk the entire time. We'd have to have like rigs and mics and somehow sync it up.
Yeah.
We'd have to figure that out.
My other convention podcast idea, which I've mentioned to you before, is I think if we go to Big Bad Con, we both buy matching sets of Heelys, like with the wheels on the heel.
Yeah.
And we just take it on the go and we just record while we're rolling around the convention center. And then when we see people,
we'd have to have wires and we'd have to just like,
oh, we can get like handheld wireless microphones, right? And just record it that way. And we just
okay,
you know, roll up on people.
I just roll Daniel and Drew roll up on people.
Yeah.
That's the episode. That could be fun. I think Big Bad Con is very much a lobby con. So we could also do the whole, we're just going to sit down at a table, set up a camera, and just talk. And then if people want to come in, they can come in.
Yeah.
We'll sign a form or whatnot. And then they'll come in and join us. I think that would be really fun.
See, I think but we should do that, but the bathroom.
Yeah, you just want to do
that. I just want to do the logistics
of the logistics of the bathroom podcast is just so difficult, especially getting permission from said facility to do it.
Yeah, we'd have to get permission from the facility and the convention.
I think we can, at Big Bad Con, I think we can easily do a car podcast.
Yep.
And we can easily do like a lobby podcast where folks can just like come in and join us because we could set up the camera. We could even just use a phone. because phone cameras are just so good now. We could set up a phone on a tripod, have like a battery running into it, just have like audio. I could literally just run audio from the phone and then have separate audio on a mic and I can just sync them up.
Yeah.
But we could do so much. And then we could, you know, rent a car or something. Or if we have friends who are going to Big Bad Con who are local and drive, we could do a podcast in their car.
Yeah.
I think that could be super
fun. I think it's super funny.
And then we can go and get food or something. I think if we went to Big Bad Con, it would be a lot of like, okay, we're going to do a whole bunch of Asians Represent content at this con.
Yeah.
And outside of this con. Use the con as an excuse to meet up.
Yeah, it's just an excuse for us to do our like zany ideas.
All our zany ideas and as many as possible in the hotel.
Yeah, because we have a limited amount of time. We have to get through all these ideas.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Just a whirlwind of content.
Yeah. We could do a trilogy of podcast recordings, and that's just like a canonical trilogy.
Format?
Yeah. Yeah.
Every con we go to, we do a bathroom episode, we do a lobby episode, we do a car episode.
Yeah, it's the Big Bad Trilogy.
The Big Bad Trilogy.
The BBT.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, Big Bad Con, if anybody from Big Bad Con is listening.
You know, if you want to sponsor this, we'll shout you out while we're there.
While we're there. Let's make this happen. Or if you folks are fans of any of our listeners are fans of these ideas.
If you're fans of us and fans of public restrooms, we're the podcast for you.
At Big Bad Con, be like, we need Daniel and Drew to do No Dice, No Problem live at Big Bad Con in multiple formats.
Yeah, and we don't want to be rude. Like, we will take the bathroom that's at the farthest end of the convention, like the bathroom that nobody's going to go into. We, you know, it's not going to take the main one or anything. Like, we're not assholes. We're just pooping out of them.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, we're not going to go to Big Bad Con now.
We get these business letters in the mail.
I know. God. I'm really... Imagine if we got a ton of sponsors for that particular episode.
That would be funny.
Sponsored by Febreze. We get a candle sponsor. We get a candle sponsor or something.
Yeah.
God. That'd be good.
Clorox bleach wipes.
Or we get... Oh, man. We just need to do some in-person stuff because I feel like we could take Asians Represent to like a whole other level.
Yeah.
If we did it, if we were at least close to one another.
Yeah.
Because we can do a lot of, we can explore a lot of other tabletop games that have sort of Asian influence. We could play Infinity, which has a ton of very interesting
Asian world building. I played that Asian the other day. Building. What a good game.
Right?
I lost really badly, but what a good game.
Hey, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I sometimes getting into a new game and losing all the time is kind of comforting because there's so little pressure on you. Like right for Flesh and Blood, do you know what my Flesh and Blood record is in organized play?
What?
It's bad. So in the Blitz format, my record is one win.
Yeah.
One draw.
Okay.
10 losses.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, sure. My record sucks. The first event I went to, I went 0-4. Second event I went to, 0-4. Third event I went to, I went 2-1-1. But my draw should have been a win, but we went to time, and I was like absolutely fucking this dude up.
Mm-hmm.
But... I was playing a new deck, and I was admittedly taking a little long because I was trying to figure out the mechanics on this new deck. But I'm getting better. I'm getting better.
I have two Flesh and Blood decks now. I have
two. You have Fi.
I have Fi, and then Azalea.
Oh, Azalea, the Archer. Yeah, I've got the Azalea deck.
Because my FLGS has started doing I think like Tuesday night. Flesh and Blood games, and so because of that, they're now also stocking more like Flesh and Blood
awesome.
Content. Right?
We should play remotely. Like, yeah. It'd be relatively easy to do. There isn't spell table, but I know the Azalea stuff well enough because I have an Azalea deck.
Sure, and even if there's no technical spell table for it, I'm sure we could just use spell table to like show it all, right?
Show it all, or like we could do it. In Streamlabs, because Streamlabs has this, like, I saw this thing where it's you can actually invite another camera into your overlay.
Oh, okay.
So then we could figure out a way to do it. I think it'd be fun. I really like that game. I think it's A, because of the low pressure of me not being being very new at it. And the fact that when I got my first win, everyone was like, whoa. And I was like, fuck yeah. It was like the perfect match. Cause I just basically overwhelmed this dude.
Yeah. I have yet to play. I don't even know how to play.
I'll teach you how to play.
We should bought those two decks.
Dude, we should do it. I'll teach you how to play. Yeah. It's so easy. I recommend starting with that Fi deck, because Fi is probably the easiest hero to learn. Azalea is really complicated.
Yeah, because when I first bought Fi, that was like the only one that they had, because I guess it was easy to learn, so that's what they'd recommend people.
Fi is also the one hero where a budget deck can really still absolutely smash a high-level deck, like an expensive deck.
I will say,
Fi is really straightforward and most of his cards are cheap.
It was difficult because like they had a bunch of other ones, but
yeah,
off the rip, it was kind of hard to tell as someone who's never played Flesh and Blood, never seen gameplay, have no idea how it works. Those little blitz decks do not, like, when you're standing there at the desk of
they
the
don't FLGS, tell you what they do.
I was like, okay, I mean, the art's cool, I'll buy that one.
Fi's whole thing is that you attack as many times as possible in a turn. Okay. You basically chain attacks together. It's like that in action anime where you're just like throwing like a ton of strikes at someone.
Sure, you like Donnie Yen, Wing Chun people.
Yeah, you're like Ip Man, except Fi's whole thing is that he sucks at blocking. Mm. So the whole thing about Fi is you have to basically strategize as to how many hits you can possibly take before you swing back even stronger. Azalea is really hard because as an archer, Azalea has to like load arrows, and it's all about gambling by moving things from your top of your deck blindly into what's called the arsenal. Azalea is really cool. I played against an Azalea and lost to an Azalea last week. Azalea is basically like each turn you do like 11 damage in one shot, and you for the most part start with 20 health.
Okay.
And that's Azalea's whole thing, and Fi's whole thing is like you're throwing like four or five attacks, but they do like between 1 to 4 damage each turn. And I'm recently built a deck around a hero called Prism, who's an illusionist, and all I do is I throw angels at people. I just attack with angels.
Okay.
But they all have this keyword called Phantasm. And if they're blocked by an attack that has like an attack card that has 6 power, it basically ends my turn.
Okay.
Which when you learn the game, it really fucking sucks. But against like a character like Fi, who doesn't have any attack cards that have 6 or more power, for the most part, it's just really oppressive.
Sure.
But I played against a dude and all his attack cards that he would block with had 6 power. So I had nothing against him.
Fucking sucked. So Prism hard counters some, but then also gets really hard countered by others.
Yes. And there are ways of getting around this Phantasm thing. Like I have cards that remove Phantasm from my first attack or something.
Oh, okay.
Or like I have cards that say, oh, anything blocking has -1 attack or something to negate it.
Yeah.
But it's really cool. And I'm building a new deck for a hero called Lexi, who's also an archer, like Azalea. But Lexi is all about, instead of one arrow, trying to shoot multiple arrows per turn.
Okay. So it's really not neat. Instead of one big arrow, just like multiple little dinks.
Yeah, I'm trying to. Then like Lexi can either do ice or electric arrows. Okay. And so you can kind of build your deck around both of those or one of them. I'm building around ice. Azalea is all about like top deck manipulation. Very, very interesting. They're very different.
Yeah.
Azalea is like really hard because while most of the cards in your deck are really cheap, like 25 cents or less, Azalea's equipment is very expensive.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Her equipment's very expensive. That's the part of the game that's actually quite pricey. Is the equipment, because you're like your chest piece might be $200 for the card.
Ah, Absolutely which not.
I don't have any of that. I don't have any of that.
Nope.
But I felt like with Fi, I could still be competitive with all of my equipment being 25 cents.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's some research in that. And then some of the other heroes are technically banned in organized play right now.
As which, it goes.
Well, they do this whole thing to keep the game balanced.
Yeah, it's
where,
the win cap, and then once they hit it.
Yeah, then... the living legend status. And then they'll release a new version. So, like, there's a new version of Prism coming out in the next set.
Okay.
This is very clearly my, like, current obsession and the only time I really leave the home. Like, I think by the game store that I go to, they're primarily a flesh and blood store.
Yeah.
And I go with a friend of mine, Oliver. We go literally every Thursday and we play. And there's usually, like, 16 people there.
Yeah.
And it's super casual. Everyone is really friendly. Like, one guy was like, hey, do you want to just, like, try out using some really nice equipment, and handed me $500 worth of cards.
Damn.
To be like, hey, here, try it out. And everybody there is really friendly and it's like, hey, trying to help me like play better. And it's been really nice being a learner and not thinking, oh, I need to make content. Oh, I need to do this. It's been really great. I realize that not all stores are like that, but I'm very happy. Shout out to Negative Zone Comics.
Yeah, I have yet to go to so Miniature Market, which is here in St. Louis. They are great. Love them to death. The staff are very, very friendly. People I've met there are friendly, like just in terms of other visitors. But I just have not walked in for the purpose of playing games with strangers. I would definitely need a buddy to go with me.
Yeah, I went alone the first time and it was intimidating, but everyone was super friendly. So that's why I was like, oh, I'm going to come back. I'm going to keep doing this.
Sure.
But I'll teach you how to play. It's super easy. You can pretty much learn in, I'd say you could learn the game in less than 30 minutes.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Especially if you're
It's probably not that hard. I mean, the difficulty is probably in like understanding like the synergies of things, not the actual like base mechanics, right?
Yes, yeah, 100%. Or when you're like playing Fi is very different from like playing Azalea.
Sure.
So kind of learning about the key cards and the key things that each hero is trying to achieve.
Yeah.
That's where the gameplay gets really deep.
Yeah. My FLGS Miniature Market, I mean, they do like, God, they do everything. I mean, they do Magic. They do Flesh and Blood. They do Battletech, Warhammer, Star Wars, X-Wing, Armada, and Legion.
X-Wing is so cool.
Yeah. Listen, I'm talking.
X-Wing is so cool.
I'm trying to talk one of my coworkers into getting into X-Wing or Armada because he loves Star Wars and has never gotten into like miniature games. And I was like, listen.
The quality of those minis.
Yeah, pre-made.
They are really nice.
Well-painted, you know, cheap. Compared to a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can get a starter kit and play, because X-Wing's in its second edition right now.
Uh-huh.
And you can get like a starter kit and it's got everything you need.
Yeah.
One of my friends, Matt, who you've talked to in my Discord server, he was really into X-Wing. So we played a bit.
Yeah.
I think it's a cool game.
Ooh. The new Star Wars Shatterpoint.
Just came out. Miniature game.
Yeah.
A skirmish game.
Having played Marvel Crisis Protocol, which is by the same team.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's the same team. It uses a lot of the same mechanics, which I think is great because Marvel Crisis Protocol is an excellent game. It is. That is an unrealistically fun game to play. I highly recommend it. It feels very dynamic. It feels very cool to play.
I didn't know they were the same company.
Yeah, if I remember correctly. They even use the same like movement markers and everything. But that game is great. So I would assume Shatterpoint is also great.
It's a matter of, I guess, finding a community.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the minis are gonna be awesome. Like the sculpts, first of all, for Shatterpoint are incredible.
Yeah, they look great.
But if you can't find people to play with, it's just kind of dead.
Yeah. So let's say I'm very thankful that my boy Sam, one of my local friends, We will often try to get together on Tuesday nights to try to play something because we both own so many different games, whether it's Infinity. We both own Infinity. We both own Battletech. We both own Warhammer 40K, Age of Sigmar.
So you could Match play the Kill Team.
Yeah, we could do whatever we wanted, you know. But he also owns, I think at this point he owns every single thing for Marvel Crisis Protocol. That's been his big, like, I want everything from that game.
They're nice minis. I remember when they launched it at Gen Con. Beautiful minis.
Yeah. And he's very good at painting. He's all in on the miniatures. So that makes it easy then because I get to just go over and be like, yeah, we'll play Marvel Crisis Protocol. And I don't have to bring a single thing. It's all right there.
See, that's awesome. See, that's awesome. I think that's what I have right now with Flesh and Blood and Magic.
Yeah.
I don't know. After that Pinkerton stuff and
yeah,
and everything, I have a hard time with Magic right now. Despite having pre-ordered the Commander decks for the Lord of the Rings set coming out.
Yeah, the day before the Pinkerton stuff came out is when I bought those new Commander decks.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, beans.
I have fun playing. I have fun playing and like we played last week. Yeah. Emma, our friend Jonathan and I, we had a game and it was really close. Yeah. But I have fun playing, but I don't know if I could do, like, I think it'd be fun to make, like, Commander content, even though there's so many people making that. But I just feel guilty playing it sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's something I struggle with. It's just, like, and I know you and I wanted to talk about Jeremy's question in our mail time. Because Jeremy asked, like, what's a company that the two of y'all used to ride hard for back in the day, but since either view critically or hate? Like, example that Jeremy wrote, being like a big WotC stan and now criticizing them, or in his case, Nintendo.
God, I can't stand Nintendo.
What have they done recently? Because I know that they just, like, there was that YouTuber that they took down.
Yeah, it's pretty much, I don't know. I do not, because I don't like Nintendo very much, and I'm also I am not the target audience for their games. Like, everyone's freaking out about the new Zelda
Tears
game.
Tears of the Kingdom. Yeah, oh, and dude, I'm just, it's so, like, good. Like, Sarah's playing it in the background right now.
I don't hate it. I'm just like, good for you, buddy. Like, I don't care, you know? But, so that means that I don't also keep up with Nintendo news, but my understanding is it's just more of the same bullshit, right? You know, where they want you to enjoy the game in the way that they think you should enjoy it, and they don't understand the internet or content creation.
Yes.
And they don't understand how these people have helped them grow over the years and why, like, this, you know, like the Smash community through the tournaments helped make Smash Bros. The success.
Oh, and then
that
they killed it.
And then they kept, you know, trying to kill it, you know, all over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like,
yep.
I don't know. I don't understand how a company like Nintendo has survived to this day based on the decisions that they've made.
Well, I mean, they have extremely hardcore fans.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, like,
and
respect,
I mean,
the
Mario movie is, like, absolutely crushing it. They've just been around for a long time. They've always been innovative with their consoles. Like, they own handheld.
Sure.
Right now. They, like, Sony, they, the PS Vita was the last handheld that Sony had. And, like, Xbox, I guess you could say, like, xCloud is handheld, but I don't think they own the market like Nintendo does with the Switch. Or like they previously did with the 3DS and the DS
and
the Game Boy.
And see, maybe I'm missing out on something because I don't understand the importance of handheld. Like, I don't see the value in it. Because if I'm out and about, I'm out and about. I'm not playing games.
I guess because, like, for me, I have, like, really fond memories of playing Pokemon in the car on, like, a family road trip.
See, I get motion sickness so bad.
For handhelds, like, if I have to go to the office, I take public transit because I got in a bike accident and I totaled my bike.
Sure.
But, like, I take public transit right now. And what do I do on public transit? I play Chrono Trigger on my phone.
Uh-huh.
And it's the only time I play Chrono Trigger, like, when I'm outside.
I understand the value of like mobile gaming on your phone because you already
have handheld consoles.
I'm not taking a backpack with me and putting a $200-$300-$400 console in there to then carry with me everywhere, you know?
Yeah, I get that. I haven't taken my Switch outside of my home in years, but we are going on Sarah and I are going on a road trip to Ottawa for a funeral. But I'm going to bring the Switch with me because I want to play Tears of the Kingdom. Yeah. But I think I would only consider bringing the Switch with me if I've got a game I really want to play. Because the last vacation we took was last June, and we went to a cottage, and I had no interest in bringing my Switch. And that was actually at the time when Diablo Immortal came out, and I was playing it a little bit. And then I realized how much of a fucking grind that game is, yeah, and how like predatory that game is. And so that entire trip, I was mostly just like reading books and eating M&Ms.
Yeah. So I mean, pursuant to the question, for me right now, oh boy, it's Blizzard.
Activision
for
Blizzard.
Sure, right? Yeah, it's Activision 100%. Blizzard. 100%. Which, like, you know, to be fair, it's been Activision Blizzard for a long time, right?
And for
in terms
years.
Of, for, yeah, they've been fucking up for a long time. So I guess even more specifically, it's the Overwatch team, right?
Yeah, with specifically around the canceling of the PvE content for Overwatch 2.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, back in 2019, when Overwatch 2 was announced, Overwatch 2 was touted as being this incredible PvE experience where there's going to be highly replayable missions with very customizable characters. You know, you could play Reinhardt and through his skill tree make him a completely different character, you know, and really kit him out and change up how he plays. And that would be true then for all these different characters. And they were really pushing for this like super high replayability, excellent campaign, narrative storytelling, mm-hmm, blah, 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 blah. And then people started going, oh, well, this must be why Overwatch 1 is dead and basically gets nothing in terms of updates or anything else.
Well, they shut down the servers like the day before the launch of Overwatch 2.
Yeah. But like leading up to that, it was like, oh, okay, this must be why we're getting literally nothing like for this game, is because of this Overwatch 2, which was like, okay, well then Overwatch 2, everything. I think everyone was very optimistic and hopeful then that Overwatch 2 would knock it out of the park. Overwatch 2 last year goes live as a PvP experience, very similar to Overwatch 1, except with an engine upgrade,
Battle
as
Pass.
Well as, you know, yeah, and now it's free to play and it's 5v5, not 6v6. And, you know, but everyone's like, okay, this is like the breath of fresh air. You know, let's get this ball rolling. And, you know, but where is PvE? And they said, well, you know, PvE will be coming. We are working on it. Mm. And everyone, I think, went, okay, well, it, you know, they probably need an additional revenue stream. This revenue is probably going into the PvE experience, you know, knock it out of the park, you know, great stuff. If it's not going to be great, then just delay it. Well, as of last week or so, lo and behold, and last week being like mid-May, lo and behold, they say, no, we're not doing PvE anymore, or at least not in the same way. All the things that you got really hyped about, we're not doing that anymore. We'll still do some story missions, but they'll come out piecemeal across various seasons. But don't worry, you're going to have fun with those. Which, if those story missions are going to be anything like the story missions that they've already done across Overwatch 1, and I don't know if Overwatch 2's gotten any story missions. I don't remember.
I mean, didn't they do... Like, I don't have a lot of time on Overwatch 2. I have, like... I think for context, you and I both played a lot of Overwatch. Like, I have, like, 1,600 hours on Overwatch 1.
Yeah.
Like, I played a lot of Overwatch 1. And it was one of my favorite games.
Same.
And then Overwatch 2, I had next to no interest in. You and I played a little bit. Mm-hmm.
I played a lot more.
You bought the Battle Pass, right?
Yeah, I maxed out the Battle Pass on, the first two seasons.
Yeah, and, for me, I didn't put any money into it. I just wanted to see what it was. And for me, honestly, the change from 6v6 to 5v5 and then the role shift for some heroes and some, changes in abilities, honestly, that could have just been a huge update to Overwatch 1.
Yeah.
Knowing that they aren't doing the PvE anymore.
Yeah.
And it sucks because I think a lot of people were really invested in Overwatch 2 and really excited about what was to come. But
the justification for the 2 on Overwatch was this brand new experience.
This PvE.
Yeah. That was basically likened to things like Vermintide, where it's just this sprawling, highly replayable network of missions that you could select from and play and advance storylines and level up your character and get new gear and shit like that. It was touted as being that sort of a game.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're probably just going to get jumbled up story games or story missions where the story's interesting, but you play it once, maybe twice, and then
they'll do PvE events like Halloween.
Yeah, they'll just do more PvE events that are just not interesting.
But that's just Overwatch 1. That's just Overwatch 1. I feel the same. I think, to answer Jeremy's question, I think WotC is obviously a really complicated one for me, having worked with them. What they've done with the Pinkertons and stuff, objectively bad.
Yeah.
Zero support from me for WotC for that. That's what, on record, terrible. I think the way the Summit was handled, they fumbled that shit real hard. I think my relationship with WotC products is complicated because it's I still have we have our D&D game.
Yeah.
And I enjoy playing Magic the Gathering. But will I buy a lot of stuff? Nah, not really. And do I need to buy stuff? No, because I don't really need anything to play D&D.
Sure.
Really don't. I guess it further makes things complicated because I got a package from them in the mail last week. And they were like, oh, thanks for attending Summit. Here's some stuff. Am I going to use it? Probably not. I'm actually going to give one of them away.
Yeah.
They gave me one of the alt art covers for Keys from the Golden Vault.
Oh, yeah.
They gave me two boxes of the campaign cases, so the creature and terrain. You know those little sticky tokens, the reusable ones?
Sure.
Yeah. It's called campaign case. They sent me two of those. And then they sent me one of the deluxe edition boxes of the Dragonlance sort of adventure. So it comes with the board game and the book, but they already sent me one of those, and again, unsolicited. I don't get paid for this stuff. I don't ask for this stuff. And there was never an expectation that I talk about them. They sent me that stuff last November, so I end up having a duplicate of a product that I'm never going to use. So I'm going to give it to Mark.
Yeah.
who's I know, a big Dragonlance fan. Because I'm going to see him this Friday when I drive out to Ottawa. But I don't know. I have just a complicated relationship with them. I think how they've treated the product kind of sucks. I think how they sent Pinkerton agents really fucking sucks. How they handled the OGL thing really fucking sucks. How Summit was handled really fucking sucks. But I've been playing D&D since I was 11 years old. So it's harder to, I would say I love D&D, but I don't love WotC. And they're kind of it's hard to separate the two of them.
Sure.
At least for me.
I mean, with Overwatch, I mean, the thing is that Overwatch, Warcraft, Starcraft, Diablo, these are a lot of my top 10 franchise, Blizzard, not Activision Blizzard, Blizzard. back in the day was my number one publisher. I would play anything that they put out. And I did.
Hearthstone.
Except for World of Warcraft, because it's an MMO, and I just don't get along with MMOs by and large. But I love world, and I love the story, you know, and I love all that kind of stuff. And so, like, when all of the, like, Activision Blizzard cases of assault and harassment and really some really disgusting, heinous activities and behaviors and abuse within the company came to light, that's hard, you know? And it's like, you know, how do I navigate that? You know, which is not that difficult compared to, you know, the people that are living those experiences and becoming targets from pretty nasty people, both before it came out and, you know, because they were brave enough to say something. So, like, the pressures that I faced, not that big in the grand scheme of life. But it's like these.
Like,
are,
imagine if you were a content creator,
yeah,
and your livelihood was based on those games.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure a lot of Overwatch 2 content creators are in a crisis, especially those that have been doing this for a very long time. But what kind of helped me be like, okay, I'll get back into Overwatch 2 was that the Overwatch team, from what I understood, by and large, had nothing to do with these company allegations. You know, they were kept separate, and Jeff Kaplan, the game director, you know, kind of kept them separated from all of the nightmare that Activision and the higher ups in Blizzard kind of brought into the fold. You know, and then of course, Kaplan left, which honestly might, you know, have been because they found out that they couldn't do this PvE experience anymore. And he was always pushing for the PvE constantly.
Yeah, that was his baby,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he had always wanted that sort of storytelling. And he has always been the advocate for PvE, it seemed. But that helped me, you know, be like, okay, I don't like Activision Blizzard. And I think that a lot of this is very heinous. And I'm trying to navigate this as best I can and boycott various things and not engage with various things.
Yeah.
But I love Overwatch and I love the team behind it. And they've always, you know, they seem like good people and they seem that they're separated from this nasty stuff. You know, and while, yes, it's the whole thing of like, but you want to support the devs, but the devs are getting paid anyways. Like, you know, like there's that whole discourse. On you know, supporting games for the sake of the devs. You know, I felt like it was all right to maybe do a little bit of buying into Overwatch 2 and spending a little bit of money. And now I don't regret it, but now I'm like with this kind of recent, I think, breaking of promises from the Overwatch team. Now it's
loss
just
of trust.
Like, yeah, it's loss of trust, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like, what's going to happen to Diablo 4? Because I know you and I were both...
God, I'm so excited for it, but, you know...
Excited, but also, like, what the fuck's gonna happen with it, right?
Yeah.
Is it going to launch disastrously like Diablo 3 did? Is it going to have this weird, broken marketplace and economy? Is it going to be, like, this huge pay-to-win experience like Diablo Immortal? Also, like, the company is like clearly showed that they don't care about this awful internal culture that they have.
I haven't heard about it in quite a while, so I don't know what the.
I'm sure that there are legal reasons why, but also like this whole Microsoft merger and everything, and how you know that's being that's been rejected by the FTC, and it's been rejected by that regulating body that's in the UK as well. And I have really complicated feelings. Like, so to circle back, I think to answer Jeremy's question, I think the answer for you and I is actually Activision Blizzard.
Yeah.
Like, huge fans, but I just can't. despite being very excited about Diablo 4, like, I don't know if I'll buy the game. Like, I don't know. I certainly won't make any content or stream it or anything like that. Certainly won't. But yeah, I have really complicated feelings about Activision Blizzard and WotC for that.
I think with Overwatch 2, a lot of the new-ish stuff, the stuff that they're now kind of promising, is supposed to come out on the roadmap in like season 6, I think 2 seasons from now. I might pick it up then again, since, you know, it's free to play. It's, I don't think my 4 hours of seeing what's up is going to make a huge difference in the grand scheme of any of it. But I might pick it up again just to see what's
going on.
Based on what we were promised, what we got, you know, and just see what's up with it. But
yeah,
you know, we'll see.
I just, very complicated feelings about Activision and WotC.
So many dookie companies have to exist.
Yeah, I just
fuck up my enjoyment of things.
Yeah, I just, it sucks. But hey, at least we have each other.
Okay.
We have each other. All right.
I just leave this the call.
Yeah, just you're just done. Just okay. Right. Show's canceled. We're never doing this again.
You fucking thought. Boop, boop.
Why don't we move on to another question?
Sure.
Because I know that we could kind of
we could just keep rolling.
We could just keep talking about Activision Blizzard and why we're really upset about it. But I think we would just keep repeating ourselves.
Yeah.
Why don't we go to Most Honorable? Most Honorable had a question, and it was like, what's a not as well-known fictional world that you think would make a great campaign setting? And I know you would say Overwatch. I know you would be interested in Overwatch and the
To be fair, Omnic I think that's a pretty War. Well-known. I think that's a pretty well-known.
Pretty well-known one.
It's not exactly indie, you know?
I don't think the question is indie, or I think it's more along the way I interpreted this question is very much like, what's something that people might not have ever thought would be a campaign?
Oh, I see.
My first thing was like, oh, I know Drew's going to say something about Overwatch.
I would love it. I'm not lying.
Our feelings about it.
I would love it.
Yeah. I actually have an answer to this one.
I'm looking around my room for inspiration.
I would say the world of most recently Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom. But for me, I don't find the world all that interesting, but I like the aesthetic of it. I like how they've used sort of like Jomon archaeology in Breath of the Wild, and I love how they've used sort of late and early Bronze Age Chinese sort of archaeology as inspirations for some of the technology in Tears of the Kingdom. I like how they've really taken this world that has a lot of inspiration from European fantasy and really injected Asian influence into it in a very interesting way. But I don't think that it would make a great campaign setting. For me, there's two. One is the world of Genshin Impact. And I know that one is like, it's like lesser known, and I've definitely talked about it.
Sure.
I really like the world of Genshin Impact, and I like how it's kind of varied and very interesting. It's got this mythos behind it. That's one that I would 100% drop money on if they were like, hey, we've got a campaign setting or a TTRPG. The, I guess, not as well-known one, at least maybe to our audience or to TTRPG folks, is the world of Kentaro Miura's Berserk. That's the one I would pick. Have you ever read Berserk or watched like the anime or the movies or anything like that?
I've seen like clips that friends have shown me. Okay. Like, oh my god, he's got this big sword. He's so cool.
He's so edgy. He's guts. So edgy. I really like the world of Berserk. I think it's really interesting. The story is not, I've said this on the podcast before, it is not for everyone. It's extremely dark, but I think the world is very interesting. I think that would be a really cool sort of like grim dark campaign setting to play in. The second one would be the world of, I think this would be an interesting TTRPG. Mm-hmm. The world of Fullmetal Alchemist, I think would be another very interesting one. That's what I would pick. Those are my two picks. It would be the worlds of Berserk and Fullmetal Alchemist.
Oh, God. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking so hard.
You're still looking around your room?
Oh, I'm looking through my Steam library now. I'm trying to find anything that would be interesting.
And oh, that I don't would think be it has cool. to be video games.
Okay. I have one.
Okay.
I think the World of Hunt Showdown
oh.
would be so cool.
Okay.
As like a survival okay. horror TTRPG setting kind of thing. So for those who don't know, Hunt Showdown is set in like an alternate history of like the Louisiana sort of deep south bayou. And it is a post-American Civil War alternate history where zombies exist, basically. Basically,
and like other creatures,
yeah,
other
like
horrors.
Occult zombie necromancy things have happened, and so you have this really, really unique take on like post-Civil War culture and weaponry in this really cool setting of the bayou where there's just like swamp zombies and shit everywhere. And it has really interesting
swamp
lore.
Zombies.
So swambies, as I like to call them. And it's a great game. Really fantastic game. I wish it was like a single player version of it. I think that'd be a really interesting open world experience.
Almost like Far Cry in a sense.
Yeah, like Far Cry or Fallout, you know.
Or Far Cry 2, yeah. Where it's like hyper realistic. Oh, take your malaria pills.
Yeah.
Did you see that that interview where the general manager of Hunt Showdown said that 40% of players have never killed another player?
Yeah, which is wild to me. Because I've killed so many players.
Well, I'm assuming that means that a lot of people have tried the game and were just like, not for me, and then just like
it's possible.
Go back to it.
But it's also listen. Hunt Showdown, so for a little bit of extra for those who don't know, it is very much in the same genre as like Escape from Tarkov, where it is a bunch of battle. It is a more realistic battle royale where everyone's dumped into the same like hunting ground and you can shoot at anyone and everything. You know, you have the PvE element of the zombies and the different other creatures that spawn. You have the other hunters in the area that. You know, and then you have one or two final bosses, which are the bounties, and you want to kill those bosses and then banish them and then extract their bounties and be able to get to an end zone, like an extraction point. There are many players in that game who are just straight up rats. They are just rats who are creeping around all the time. Whose first instinct when they come across another player is to get the fuck out or just go really still and just crouch in a corner until you leave. So it does not surprise me that.
But that's a viable strategy in that game.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That would be a cool campaign setting though. That'd be a very cool campaign setting. I think you could almost. I think it would be interesting if you had a big setting and it was like a hex crawl and you were moving from hex to hex and you could dictate if you want to move like in a stealthily manner or if you want to move aggressively and then you would have your like sort of encounters. I think that would be really neat.
Yeah.
And you could track your ammo like we talked about with the Daniel and Drew Survive the Apocalypse episode. You can like track ammo. And I think it would be interesting if failure to do like skill checks and stuff actually resulted in noise because I know sound is really important in Hunt Showdown.
Sound is super important.
And I think having a noise mechanic essentially represent your threat level or the threat level of the environment on you might be a really cool thing to bring into a stealth-based TTRPG.
Yeah, I think that'd be really cool because like if you're in Hunt Showdown, the sound is so important because you can... You know, it's a bayou, so there's tons of like mud and water, and so when you can hear someone's barefoot grippers just walking through the mud from 20 yards away, and you're just like, oh shit, was that little extra step one of the zombies that are walking around? Because you obviously hear them as well, or was that an extra footstep that didn't belong? Oh, like, and you just get real nervous all of a sudden. God, what a good game.
Yeah, and it's a matter of trying to replicate that. In sort of like a TTRPG experience where you're also being, there is the potential for you to be hunted as well.
Yeah.
And I think there's this like interesting, there's the potential for you to basically be like, I am the hunter right now. And then if you fuck up enough, you are becoming hunted.
Yeah, I think that'd be cool. You can even use like like the Forge in the Dark system, right?
The with the clocks.
With the clocks.
Yeah.
Where you make too much noise and then suddenly now flips around and you're now hunted. Ooh, Dying Light could use the same idea.
Even. Yeah, you could do that with Dying Light.
Where it's like but use it as like phases of the day. When it gets to nighttime, then they those super zombies come out.
Ooh. Yeah.
And you run out of time.
Yeah, that'd be neat. But then you'd have to...
Dying Light would also be a cool one. I'm going to say that right now.
Yeah. I think with Dying Light, if it were a TTRPG, you'd have to figure out... You'd have to make parkour really engaging. Like the movement.
You as a person have to do it before you roll.
You have to do it. Like, okay, I need you to go and jump off that building into a glider.
Yeah.
I think you'd have to have a fail forward system.
Yes.
Like you can't... Okay, roll the jump over this crate.
I failed.
No, you die. You bump your shins. Okay, you're dead. I think it would have to be a fail forward system.
Yeah, for sure.
Or something where you accrue stunt points or something. You can just spend them to succeed on things.
Yeah, I don't know. So aside from like fictional settings, I guess what I really want right now for some interesting settings are like more grounded historical or historical adjacent things.
Yeah.
Like I would really love some of that kind of stuff right now. I love fantasy. I love sci-fi. I love all the genres, but I'd really like some historical or like pseudo historical stuff. I'm not going to say it has to be exactly this thing. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly
play Ross rifles.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be like exactly like the 6th century CE or anything like that. But, you know, it can have its pseudo history. It can have its, you know,
yeah. There's Aegon. Have you played Aegon?
I think I own Aegon. I've never played it.
Aegon's a cool one.
Honestly, I don't know if it's so much that I want these settings to exist. I think a lot of these things do exist. It's just nobody wants to play them with me.
So you need a group that is interesting.
Like I'd really love to play a World War II game. The one that is the World War III that you bought.
Oh yeah, Twilight 2000.
God, I'd love to play that.
Dude, I'll run it.
Hell yeah.
I think it'd be super fun. We just got to get the right group together to do it.
It would be really
we'll figure it out.
If Emma was like, I'll play, but I don't want my character to die. So we just keep sending Emma's character forward, knowing that they won't die.
Yeah, no, you can't get attached to it. I don't think you can get attached to a character in that.
No, probably not.
But I want to run it, but I received my copy at a very awkward time.
Yeah.
And it felt weird to be like, hey, you want to play this Twilight 2000
game,
Drew?
Also, you know
how Russia invaded Ukraine?
Do you want to role play
that? I got
that?
This new RPG about the aftermath.
Yeah.
I do want to play it. I have like the nice physical box and I would love to like play it with the maps and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got to purchase the digital stuff as well. Or I might have it from the Kickstarter. I'll have to check.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm totally down. Okay, let's try to get a couple of other questions in.
Okay.
We're already at an hour.
It's so easy to fill time.
Oh yeah, I know. Okay, so we've actually answered Agatha's question as well, because Agatha also asked about like a TTRPG story or setting or genre, and I think we had mentioned we've talked about survival, we've talked about sort of an like a pseudo historical setting, more of like potentially a military genre, or I guess the survival genre, or post-apocalyptic. We have multiple questions about dice. Miss Mike and Most Honorable both asked dice questions. Miss Mike asked, if someone made a unique dice that represented you, what would it look like? I'm gonna also add to the question, Drew. how many sides would the dice have? Would the die have? And then what would be the color, or how would the die look? So it could be one of like the core dice, like D4, D6, D8, D10, all of that stuff. But what would be inside it? And what would the numbering look like? What would be the color?
So mine would be a D4 made out of bone, because my bones are bad and they hurt.
Okay. That would be yours. Okay.
That's it.
That's it.
Mine bones are bad and they hurt. Therefore, they're a D4 made out of bones.
What kind of bone?
Mine.
Yours. I would love... I think it'd be really cool to have a D20, but it would be made of a dinosaur fossil.
That'd be cool.
That'd be heresy though, because then you'd be destroying a dinosaur fossil to then make, or in line with our no dice, no problem, a whole set of coprolite dice. It's just all coprolites, fossilized poop.
Hell yeah, that'd be fun.
That'd be really cool. That'd be coprolite dice. That would be my pick, and it would be a
At least mine's locally sourced. I'd like a D20.
Sourced. Yeah. I mean, I could find locally sourced coprolites.
Sure.
if I were to pick like a transparent one, I would... Ooh, I just dropped this die. I would love to have tiny little trilobites inside the dice.
Ooh, that'd be sick.
That'd be really cool. If you've ever seen... Have you seen trilobites that are prepared in a way where they look as though they are actually emerging out of the stone?
No.
So instead of impressions, oh my god, dude, they are I'm gonna pull up some. I went to this museum in Houston, their natural history museum, and they had some incredible trilobites. I have them on the screen for our patrons who watch, who can get access to the video. But I think most people, when they see trilobite fossils, they see the sort of the impressions, or they're very flat. But there are some very rare trilobite fossils where the exoskeleton is preserved, and so the prep teams at the museum actually like carve them out of the surrounding rock, so you can see the spines.
Oh, everything. I see. That's cool.
It's very cool. But I think having like trilobite inside die. Like a dice set, that'd be really neat. That'd be my pick. Most honorable also asked, if dice were edible, how should that feel as a chew, and how should it taste? So mouthfeel and flavor.
Okay. So, you know, like, if you've ever been to, like, I don't know, a historic site of any kind, and they have those, like, 50-cent long stick stick candies, but then they also have the sugar crystal rock candy on the long wooden rod.
Stick.
Yeah. It would be like that, but smooth, right? It would have that sort of sugar crystal mouth crunch and probably taste, but it'd be smooth, like, you know, because it'd be a cube.
Ooh, mine. What I would do is I would do it like hot ones.
Okay.
And they would be gummy dice.
Okay.
But then they would escalate in terms of Scovilles.
Oh, okay. But they escalate alongside the amount of sides on the dice.
The amount of sides.
Yeah. So D20 kills you.
D20 would kill you, and then you would basically go from like a D4, it's like, oh, this is nice and sweet, and they would just slowly ramp up. Yeah. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
That'd be my The extra question would be, what would Chessex dice taste like? Or would they taste the worst?
They taste like coprolite.
Rock?
Yeah, just like fossilized poop.
Yeah, we don't like Chessex dice here.
No.
We're Chessex haters. Yeah. Show.
You'll see.
Can you imagine? We do a con recording. It's like, this episode of No Dice, No Problem is sponsored by Chessex. Okay. Get your dice.
Okay, you know how like, at conventions, most of these like booths, the only thing separating them from other booths are just like black felt, like cloth, you know, stuff like that. What if we just park on the other side of that for the Chessex booth, and we're just shitting on them in a recording right behind them?
Oh man, what? Oh, that'd be
fun. No, I think Chessex is good. I just don't think that anyone needs more of them. Unless we're sponsored, in which case, when it comes to bang for
your buck, use code problem. I think the message of the Chessix episode we did was
we hate poor people.
No. the message of that episode was consider your Asian dads are telling you how to save your money and don't buy Chessix dice. Buy beautiful handmade dice or support your local dice makers if you want to aggrandize dice.
Why buy 10 sets of $8 dice when you could buy one set of $80 dice?
Yeah, really nice ones too. Yeah. Or we can't even afford the Yanier dice. Those are so nice.
Yeah, those are.
God, those are so nice. Okay, so we have a question from Billman who asked, have you ever run into puzzles RPG or otherwise that make use of like other senses like auditory, like feel or scent? Basically, like incorporating senses into, I guess, tabletop RPG puzzles or in your campaign. I think that's the question.
Yeah, because I'm assuming Billman is not talking about a game called Puzzles RPG, but rather puzzles in RPGs, or like RPGs that are based around puzzles.
I'm gonna look Puzzles RPG. No, that's definitely not it. Unless it's just poor branding and we can't find Puzzles the RPG.
Yeah.
I think it's puzzles in RPGs. I'm not a big fan of putting puzzles into like TTRPGs.
Puzzles make me mad.
Because I think they also like tell the party that there's only one way to solve this problem. And I think with my style, I want people to be able to go and like figure out a creative answer. So it's like, oh, we can't get through this door unless we solve this very specific puzzle.
Well,
I'm not super into that.
It's not even that for me. For me, one of the struggles that I have with puzzles as a player or as a DM, it doesn't really matter. It's just, you know, as someone who engages with TTRPGs, one of the issues with puzzles is puzzles rely on data, on accurate data. You know, puzzles can't be misleading in that sense. You know, you have to be able to rely on so many different things. And so if you are just relying as a player you are not receiving the puzzle from the DM. You are receiving an interpretation of the puzzle from the DM. And you might actually pick up on certain things because the DM happened to emphasize it that way through natural speech patterns. And you're completely off the grid, right?
100%. There has to be something tactile presented to you.
And then you might
otherwise, if I'm describing a room to you
and
the way I'm describing the room is actually inaccurate, then you'll just never solve it.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're relying on communication that could be bad. Like it could be faulty communication. And so, therefore, you're not receiving a reliable set of data to make inferences on or to make any decisions with. And so, having a puzzle, like you were kind of saying, that has only one solution, often, at least in my experience, sent a otherwise well-paced session into the pits of nothing. Because now we're all agonizing over it. And the GM is just sitting there, whether I'm the GM or someone else is. Now you're just sitting there being like, oh, God, like, what have I done?
Yeah, and I don't want to slow down the pacing of the game to do some sort of like Resident Evil puzzle where you have to like align this weird jumble of objects behind the light to project like an image.
Yeah. And again, like, it's the same way with investigations.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing some sort of mystery in your setting. That's why those kinds of games are so potentially fraught with issues. I will not say.
Well, there are systems for it.
Yeah, there are systems that are better for it.
Like Gumshoe.
Yeah. I don't know.
But yeah.
I think it's
possible. I'm not super into puzzles.
I'm not super into puzzles either. However, I will say I think about puzzle sometimes. And I do think that putting something physically in front of players is a different story. So, you know, if you are all just in your mind palaces painting your word pictures and you're trying to understand this puzzle based on the faulty descriptions of your GM, that's mm-hmm. one thing. And I think that that's often a rough thing. And unless you are just playing ball with the player's answers and improvising the solution, I think walking in there with a set end goal and a set, like, solution that cannot change, that's a bad idea. However, if you put something physically in front of players, I think that can be different.
100%. I like the idea of, you know, maybe collecting pieces of a map and then putting them all together.
Yeah.
Or having a whole bunch of maybe sheets of paper overlap to form, and you hold it up to the light, and then you see the location of where you have to go.
Exactly.
I like that because it's like, hey, we can get these pieces of paper however we want, and then we're going to put them together to get the solution.
And not only that, you are now removing, as best you can at least, you are removing the possibility for miscommunication.
100%. So it has to be tactile. In terms of, like, senses, like scent, because that was mentioned in the question, I'm not a big fan because I know that, like, there are folks who are, like, particularly sensitive to, like, perfumes and things like that.
Yeah, it's going to have to be very particular to your group
and their absolutely.
Sensibilities and needs and desires.
So. Yeah, and it's really hard to also describe something, especially to the senses, because if folks are, like, my brother and Sarah, my partner, were trying to describe to me what different tree nuts tasted like, and for context, I am severely allergic to tree nuts, but I am in the midst of actually working with an immunologist and testing to see if I can eat some of them. And I'm actually in July going into the hospital to do, like, an exposure test to almonds. And they were trying to, like, describe to me what they taste like. And I was like, I have no idea. I can't conceive of the taste of a cashew or an almond or a pistachio, especially when you're like, oh, it tastes like a hazelnut. I was like, I don't know what a hazelnut tastes like. Like, it's really difficult when you don't have anything tactile or you are making assumptions about another player's sort of experiences with said stuff. If I'm going to do puzzles, it's going to be collecting bits of things that you put together, but it's always going to be tactile, and there really isn't room for, like, interpretation. There is going to be a clear-cut answer, but that puzzle will never be necessarily a hard barrier to advancing the story.
Yeah. And
it will be, hey, collect these pieces, put them together, and now you'll see where to go.
And I would say, it's a similar thing of, like, okay, so you have a wizard that has a 20 intelligence. You know, you're real smart. You're at the farthest boundaries of what a mortal can achieve in terms of intelligence. But obviously, that's not the rest of us. You know, that's not the average us, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's absolutely okay for you to, as a GM, DM, whatever, either let them roll an intelligence check to get a hint or to kind of push it along. You could just say, you know, hey, Ben, the wizard.
Ben, that's what you thought of.
because of your intelligence, you start to see this sort of pattern emerge from what you're seeing in front of you. And then by that way, give them a hint. Or hell, you could just try to let them have their own little moment by just, like, you know, just messaging them individually, being like, hey, here's a hint. Work off of that, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like our home game. Yeah. It's like your character is from this land and your character would just know stuff. So you're like, hey, would I know this? And I'll just tell you.
Yeah, and I will say again, to Billman's question, I think that bringing out a physical thing or bringing out some sort of physical element to a puzzle is really interesting. And in fact, for many, could make it more accessible, But then you also have to survey your group and understand what accessibility means to them. Because, you know, like we mentioned, if they're very sensitive to smells or sounds or very certain things, then obviously spritzing perfume is maybe not going to have the desired effect. It's just going to be particular to your group. So,
yeah.
But otherwise, 100%. I do think it's cool. I think it's cool.
Yeah, I like the idea of having some sort of tactile experience at the table. Really like that. But it's a tough thing to really do. Especially with, like, you have to consider so many factors. But anyways, that's kind of our perspective on that. Temporal Insanity had a question about, like, if your favorite TTRPG was a flavor of bubble tea, what kind would it be? And I've kind of struggled. I'm like, well, I don't think I have, like, a favorite TTRPG. Like, my favorite TTRPG is whatever I'm playing with my friends. I guess that's kind of a cop-out of an answer. I guess, I love D&D. I've been playing it for so long. But D&D is, like, very vanilla. It's, like, just the brown sugar milk tea. That's
what exactly
it is to
what
me.
I was going to say. Because, I'm at that crossroads that so many other people are at, where it's, like, D&D still is probably my favorite. Maybe not even because of its own merit, but just because it's the one I've played vastly more than any others. And the amount of chances I have to play D&D are far more than the chances I have to play any others. And,
like Twilight 2000.
Yeah. So I don't have as much exposure. So yeah, it's probably D&D, which is brown sugar, you know, milk tea. With bubbles.
Yeah, with which is your base tapioca, nothing extra.
Nothing extra.
Yeah, 100%. And then the last question, I wanted to save this for last, was Kat's question. What's a creative goal that you each have for the next 30 days or so? We're going to release those chi rules.
We are going to release those chi rules. That'll be fun.
Because I need everyone to go over the new draft that Jeremy put out.
Yeah.
We have been working on chi rules for 5e and Pathfinder. And through Valorous Games, we're going to kind of release it as like a small, like something like $3 with like community copies on DriveThruRPG, but it'll just be rules on how to incorporate a more nuanced concept of chi into either your D&D or Pathfinder game with associated rules for each of those systems. We're definitely going to release that within the next 30 days or so. And then is there anything else that you have as an individual and I say creative goal, I don't think that's like to publish. It could be just to finish something.
So creative goals right now for me is I'm trying to get back into like doing a lot more regular model painting and stuff. In my setting, my campaign revolves around a particular city, which is like a giant sort of fantasy, sci-fi-ish looking, city that has huge wealth disparity. It's your typical Gotham and it's your Piltover and Zaun from Arcane, from League of Legends.
Yeah.
There's a lot of gangs, and I really love there's just like a lot of criminal organizations and like different factions of law enforcement. And like, there's just a lot of interesting little factions and stuff. And so I'm trying to collect miniatures for like my visions of those specific ones.
Oh, cool.
So like one of the gangs that I'm trying to do right now are called the Bloody Hares, and they wear these like rabbit masks that are like crimson red.
That's a good name.
Yeah, they're very like, the Bloody Hares are very agile, focused, lots of parkour and shit, you know?
Yeah.
They're very fast and known for their agility. So I'm just trying to get all those kinds of things painted up, which is time consuming. And especially when you are not so locked into the hobby that you just automatically do it as your thing. I have to be in the mood. So,
yeah, my painting setup used to permanently be at my desk.
Yeah.
But when I reorganized everything in our home, my painting setup kind of had to be packed away. So I can only paint when I take it all out.
Sure.
And so it's it that's a barrier for me.
Yeah.
Also with the fact that I'm extremely burnt out.
Yeah.
For me, I'm actually going to release on like I have like a little like private Patreon that kind of just I used to hold myself accountable to like creative stuff. Where I'm putting out my a higher level preview of my campaign setting.
Yep.
That our home game takes place in. Mm-hmm. And so I actually I'm sharing our Owlbear Rodeo from our home game, but I made like a hex map and it's got all these locations and we're currently using it to track sort of where the party is going and this creature, this Tautia, that's hunting them. But what I've been doing is actually laying out particular like specific sections of the map, so different provinces and all the key locations, and I have details about them and like what the weather's like in the seasons. And then I'm going to build tables for each one, so like encounter tables within like the Azure Lowlands or within the Jade Highlands and things like that. But I think within the next 30 days, I'll have laid out all four provinces within my campaign setting.
Hoko fucking sucks.
Yeah, that place sucks. but I'm going to basically lay it all out as like a travel guide to the Land of Blades. And then I'm going to give it to like my home game. So like Drew, like your character would know all about most of these places.
Fuck yeah.
And so it gives people more, gives the players more, I guess, knowledge that, you know, they might have accumulated over the past like 2 years we've been playing. Almost.
Yeah.
It's been over 2 years. Yeah, yeah. We're in year three. We've entered year three.
Yes.
I think. Oh my God.
Been playing a while.
It's been a while. But yeah, that's what I want to finish. I'm just at the stage where I'm just writing descriptions of each of the provinces, and then all the locations are already written out. And I've used this tool called Hexkit. I got it on Itch to make all of the maps. So very excited about that. But yeah, that's all of the questions. Drew, I think we're going to call this episode Daniel and Drew Hate Puzzles in DDRPGs.
That's
what I'm thinking right now.
We are haters.
Is it Daniel and Drew Hate Puzzles or Daniel and Drew Hate Puzzles in DDRPGs?
No, I think we hate puzzles.
Okay, Daniel and Drew Hate Puzzles. That's going to be the episode. But yeah, that was... it was like a good mix of questions, but I think we got really into just hating on Activision Blizzard.
God, we love hating.
God, we really do love hating.
To be fair, Activision Shit Blizzard sucks. These days is not necessarily deserving of love. So
no, correct. You know. Absolutely.
It's not like Chessex Dice, who have verifiably, to my knowledge, done nothing wrong to deserve this. Like,
and we're actually not even hating on Chessex. We're just saying, you know.
Yeah, we're not hating on Chessex at all by telling everyone to not buy them.
Yeah, not at all. But yeah, that was Drew, I'm glad we got this done. I'm glad we have made public our intentions to record multiple podcast formats at Big Bad Con. So if folks from Big Bad Con are listening, you know how to find us.
Hell yeah.